I'm very happy to be here. Thank you all for coming out on this rainy night. Just want to make sure that you can hear me. Is that good? So I'm going to read two parts that have nothing to do with alcoholism at all, which is, I think, a good thing, because you should know that the book's about many other things as well. So this, I structured the book in a different way for me, which is that I inserted in between each chapter stories of my mother's that she used to tell, and she was a great storyteller. And it was hard for me to figure out how to get her stories down through my eyes, but still maintaining her humor and her voice. So this is, I just want to lower this a little bit. This is a story, and my mother was a renowned swearer. The only other person who swore more than my mother was my father. So I'm going to bleep out all the bad words, just so that you don't get mad at me. So this particular story of my mother's is called, "And for God's Sakes, Don't Bleep Frank Sinatra." Here is the only humorous anecdote surrounding my father's death that my mother ever told. My mother adored Lauren Bacall, known as Betty to her close friends, and they were good friends and had been friends for many years. Gloria thought Betty Bacall was the most beautiful woman she'd ever met, and she admired Betty because Betty was completely down to earth and suffered no flattery from sycophants. For several days after my father died, my mother, lying with a bottle of scotch on the couch in the living room, refused to budge. Someone called Betty Bacall, who arrived like the cavalry. Taking the situation in hand, she said to Gloria, "All right, Moss, you don't have to get up now, but you will soon. I went through it with Bogey, and I know exactly how you feel. Here's what you do. Nothing. No impulsive decisions, no rash moves. Don't start giving stuff away that you'll regret later. Don't sell the house. Don't do anything stupid. And for God's sakes, don't bleep Frank Sinatra." Betty was, of course, referring to her own disastrous rebound relationship with Sinatra in the wake of Humphrey Bogart's death. My mother started to laugh. She laughed so hard she had to sit up to avoid choking to death, and from there she finally got up and had something to eat. 2 days later, the phone rang. Gloria picked up. "Hi, Moss, it's Frank." "Frank who?" she said. "Frank, who the hell do you think? Sinatra." They had been friends for many years, but it seemed absurd to her that he'd automatically assumed that she had no other friends named Frank of importance in her life. After a pause, he said, "I called to say I'm sorry about Jim. Do you need me to come out there?" To his great astonishment, she started to giggle and couldn't stop. And this is a chapter called "Your Own Private Omaha," which has to do with the beach in Normandy where the Americans landed during World War II, during D-Day. I went there with my father when I was a young girl, when I was probably 13 years old. And I went back there on this occasion, and this chapter arose out of that experience. And in fact, interestingly, this was one of the chapters that my editor wanted to cut out of the book because he thought it wasn't completely relevant to the subject. And I thought I was going to have to fight with him to keep this chapter because this is, to me, one of the most important chapters in the book. But I said, "You know, Henry, I need to keep, we have to keep this chapter." And he said, "Okay, fine, no problem." So I didn't even have to fight with him, which I would have if I'd had to. So this chapter is called "Your Own Private Omaha." In June 2004, 2 years after I had ACL knee surgery, I attended a seminar of American writers in Caen, Normandy, to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the D-Day landings. I was still wearing my imposing neoprene and metal leg brace, but I wasn't about to turn down this opportunity. If I could walk, I could go. So I went. Richard Price, my teacher from Columbia, was also invited. I hadn't seen him in several years, but now he called me a few times to make sure I was still going. He seemed nervous about being in a strange French city without his French publisher or a translator. I told him he had nothing to worry about, that I'd translate for him if the need arose. By now, Richard was hugely successful. He'd written a number of best-selling and critically acclaimed novels, including Clockers, which was made into a Spike Lee movie, as well as several screenplays that had become box office hits. The Centre Régional des Lettres de Basse-Normandie in Caen, our host, did not have a lot of money to spend on accommodations, but the hotel, which had once been a monastery, was quaint, a nicely appointed space with small, low-ceiling bedrooms. The local Calvados was flowing freely in the evenings, and many strange, disjointed political discussions took place. I translated for our French hosts, and I was the only one besides our guide, Jérôme, who was drinking pear juice. On our last day, the Centre hired a tour bus with a guide to take us to Omaha Beach. I took two seats for myself so I could stretch out my right leg in its brace. Apparently, it was the guide's first day on the job, and his English was far from fluent. He started out the tour with a garbled lecture on the centuries-old friendship between our two nations. Having grown up with French and French accents, I could decipher most of what he was saying, but the American writers were straining, mouths agape, their faces frozen in expressions of total incomprehension as the guide waxed forth with grand gestures and words like Lafayette, Jefferson, Independence, Déclaration. Richard was sitting impatiently in the seat behind me. He grumbled through the first 20 minutes of this speech and then said to me, Go up there and tell him that we don't want a lecture on American history. Tell him to talk about D-Day and the landings. The guide must have been pushing 40, and he had a wide-open, innocent face with big, blue, sad eyes. I felt sorry for him, but I got up and moved through the rows of seats to the front of the bus and told him in French what Richard had said. Il veut que vous parliez du débarquement. The poor man looked positively petrified, but he bravely launched into his speech. He stretched out a hand flat, making a horizontal gesture, and declared, "We have a French bitch." He placed his other hand a few inches above the first hand and said, "The Nazis are on top of the bitch." And then he said, "And they are fighting over this bitch." "What bitch?" Richard asked from behind me. "He's saying beach," I translated, caught up suddenly in one of those fits of laughter that only gets worse the more you try to swallow it. "So they are fighting and fighting over this bitch. It is a long fight for the bitch. And finally, the American wins the bitch." "Great. I can't wait to hear what they do with her now," muttered Richard. "We have now the bitch under control. So it is now the time for to make in the water large erections all around the bitch. We do this way." I had one of those once, as I recall. Richard called out, and the busload of American writers erupted into howls of laughter. By now, I was laughing so much I could barely breathe to translate. I figured the tour guide was talking about the temporary floating mulberry harbors that had been constructed around Omaha Beach, so the Allied ships could disembark their materiel. I tried to stop laughing long enough to figure out what the guide was now trying to say. "And they do this why? They do this because they have too many nuts. You must to have 3 nuts or less." "I thought it only took 1 nut," Richard offered, "although 2's always better." "Knots," I said. "He's saying knots. The ships were going too fast. They had to slow them down to 3 knots or less in order to dock the ships." "How can you understand a word he's saying?" Richard asked suspiciously, poking his head through the space between the seats. "You're just making this up." I knew about the floating ports from my visit to the beaches with my father in 1973. "And now, we will present to you an emu," the guide proclaimed. "An emu? Where?" Richard stood up and looked out the windows in all directions. "They have emus in France?" The tour guide, opening a pamphlet, blew out his chest and began to recite, "Un noir de Christian soldiers marching as to war with the cross of Jesus going on before." "Him," I thought. "He's trying to say him, emu." "Is he reading Onward, Christian Soldiers?" Richard asked in horrified disbelief. "Hey," he shouted toward the front of the bus, "hey, there were Jews there too, you know, and they weren't singing that emu." My stomach ached, and I had tears streaming from laughing. By the time we disembarked at the American Military Cemetery in Colleville-sur-Mer, which lies at the top of the cliff leading down to Omaha Beach, all possibility of decorum and solemnity was lost. It was a hot, sunny, beautiful day. I tried to compose myself as I walked slowly toward the lines and lines of white crosses and intermittent stars of David that spread out in perfect symmetry, shrinking into the distance in their even rows. But the tour guide's speech kept interfering. I still felt oddly lightheaded from laughing so hard. I hadn't laughed like that in years. Dozens of buses were disgorging tourists into the parking lot, many of them German. Inside the cemetery, people were talking loudly, joking and smiling and horsing around, taking pictures of themselves in front of the American soldiers' headstones. When I was growing up in France in the 60s, the war was still strong in everybody's mind. There were whispers among the shop owners on the Île Saint-Louis, where I grew up, that the concierge a few doors down from us had been a collaborator and had helped the Nazis round up Jews. So many people said they'd been in the resistance that it seemed the whole country had been fighting against the Germans. The black and white war films I'd watched on TV as a child had left me with nightmares of Nazi jackboots marching down cobbled streets, the sound growing louder and louder as they came for the good guys, holed up in some dark apartment. The American tourists were cavorting around as much as the Germans. There seemed to be a lot of kids and teenagers on vacation. Annoyed, I wandered off by myself to the farther reaches of the cemetery, where the hordes rarely ventured. I suddenly felt very old. I remembered how quiet the cemetery had been on that cold day in December 1973 when I'd come here with my parents. We were the only visitors. The landscape, the cemetery's grass, the trees, the bushes, and the beach had seemed washed of colors, all blending in sepia tones like an old photograph. The tide had been out, and the beach seemed to stretch for miles toward England, where the choppy sea and dark cloudless sky merged on the horizon. The rusty iron anti-tank barriers shaped like giant X's had still marred the vista, a frightening reminder of what had taken place here. I wondered if they would still be visible at low tide. Finally, I looked down the path through thick flowering shrubs to the beach below, now bustling with chattering tourists. My knee was aching and I did not want to limp all the way down there, but I felt I had to. I made my way with mincing steps down the steep path. It was high tide, and the beach was just a narrow, rocky strip that looked like any other beach in the area. The tourists seemed to be standing around, waiting for something to happen. I tried, but could not conjure up a picture of the scene in 1944. I'd also been to Omaha Beach once before our visit in 1973, when I was 9 months old. In 1961, my mother and I accompanied my father on a business trip. He was writing the dialogue for the American sections of the screenplay, The Longest Day, based on the book by Cornelius Ryan. My father's friend Romain Gary, the renowned French author, soldier, and diplomat, was writing the French dialogue, and Eric Maria Remarque, the German author of one of the greatest anti-war novels ever written, All Quiet on the Western Front, was writing the German scenes. My father combed the D-Day beaches and tried to imagine what it must have been like. This was only 16 years after the end of the war, and nothing much had changed in the landscape. The German fortifications were still intact, and from his position on the beach, the pillboxes stared down ominously from the bluffs. I'm certain he could still hear the explosions and the shooting and the shouting and the crying of the wounded. When we visited the beaches in 1973, my father told me, his eyes watering from the cold or from emotion, that in 1944, after he'd recovered from his ankle surgery in an army hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, he'd received orders to return to combat duty with a regiment that was soon shipping out for Europe. He knew he would have been part of the invasion force and was certain he would not survive. "I knew my luck had run out," he told me. So he went AWOL and pretended to be insane, or maybe he really was a little insane, and started fights in bars until the Army saw fit to give him an honorable discharge. As research for his screenplay on The Longest Day, my father toured the Normandy shore from Utah Beach, 10 or 12 miles farther east, to Omaha Beach. He had no trouble imagining what the men must have felt facing German artillery and machine gun fire. There's a wonderful description of it in his nonfiction book, WW2, which recreated the war from the soldiers' point of view. It's a synthesis of his own recollections, analysis, anecdotes, and graphic art from the war. In his words, D-Day looked and sounded much like Steven Spielberg's version in Saving Private Ryan. Quote, "The terror and total confusion, men screaming or sinking silently under the water, tanks sinking as their crews died inside, landing crafts going up as a direct hit took them, or grating ashore to discharge their live cargo into the already scrambled mess, officers trying to get their men together, medics trying to find shelter for the wounded, until out of the welter, a certain desperate order emerged, and men began to move toward the two bottleneck exits. I sat there until my friends began to yell at me, and I fervently thanked God, or whomever, that I had not been there." There were more artists at Normandy than at any other battle in World War II. The Germans may not have known where the Allies planned to invade, but the Allied photographers and writers certainly did. Paintings show men with their arms shot off, bodies slung over the iron crosses on Omaha Beach like casual crucifixions, a battlefield execution of a German soldier, blindfolded and bound. My father described some extremely graphic carnage in The Longest Day, but Hollywood censors were displeased. His final assessment of the film was that it did not honestly portray war and warfare, especially the carnage suffered by Americans on Omaha Beach. They removed all of the soldiers' language, which my father had already softened, in an attempt to pass the production code's litmus test. Jeffrey Sherlock, the production code administrator, objected to the, quote, "casual profanity and vulgar dialogue, crap, stuff it, mother lover, SOB, bastards, geez, damn, all had to go." Sherlock's conclusion, quote, "We are concerned with what seems to us to be an excessive amount of slaughter in this story. We realize that it is impossible to tell the story of the invasion of Normandy without indicating the staggering loss of human life. We do urge you, however, in those scenes you stage, to minimize the dramatization of personal killings. We think that such an effort on your part would avoid the bloodbath effect." My mother, in order to lift my father's spirits, took to calling the censor "No Shit Sherlock." My father's response to "No Shit Sherlock's" letter was, "What do they think war is, if not a bloodbath?" Ultimately, my father wrote a blistering 10-page memo to the studio criticizing the final script of The Longest Day, demanding that his name be removed from the credits. My father wrote the following in 1963 in an article for the Saturday Evening Post as a result of his experience on the set of The Longest Day. Quote, "Most deaths in infantry combat are due to arbitrary chance, a total random selection by which an unknown enemy drops a mortar or artillery shell onto or punches an MG bullet into a man he has never seen before and perhaps never does see at all. Such a death is totally reasonless and pointless from the viewpoint of the individual because it might just as well have been the man next to him. It only has meaning when it is viewed numerically from a higher echelon by those who count the ciphers. And for that very reason, it is a much more terrifying death to the individual soldier and to an audience seeking meaning when they go to the movies." My father would have been outraged by the message in Saving Private Ryan that the just and fair U.S. government would expend the energy and manpower to locate Mrs. Ryan's one last surviving son, one man among the myriad soldiers whose lives were at stake that day. My father believed that war and warfare turned most men into animals, not heroes. And the individual in warfare doesn't count, never did, and never will. And anyone who says otherwise is lying. But people in general would rather believe a Spielberg film over the soldier writers who dedicate their lives to trying to debunk such glorifying myths. It is much safer and more comfortable to believe in the notions of a good war and that no American ever died or killed in vain. Our modern society has managed to turn a good many legendary battles into successful films and video games. Herodotus wrote in his histories about 300 Spartans who in 480 BC held off a Persian force of 80,000 men for 3 days at the Thermopylae Pass. But why read the difficult Herodotus when we can now experience this famous battle in a graphic novel called 300? And if we don't want to read it all, there's a film based on this book, complete with supernatural creatures, a huge commercial success. There's even a video game of the Omaha Beach assault created in the wake of Saving Private Ryan, in which we may virtually experience killing Nazis, getting blown up, deploying Bangalore torpedoes, storming the German pillboxes, and saving the day. My friend Ray Elliott, former president of the James Jones Literary Society, writer and former Marine, had a cousin, Bruce Elliott, who participated in the Omaha Beach landing. A neck injury Bruce received during the war bothered him for the rest of his life, and he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. He was able to hold down a job until his last few years, when he was forced to go on total disability. Bruce Elliott eventually shot himself on D-Day in 1982, a statement heard loud and clear by his family. Ray visited Omaha Beach on several occasions. In 1994, for the 50th anniversary, he attended the ceremonies on a D-Day pass granted by the Pentagon, thanks to Bruce's service. During that visit, Ray noticed a number of young faux soldiers in vintage U.S. military garb and medals tooling around the countryside in World War II U.S. Army jeeps, boys playing war. Ray went back in 2004, just a few weeks before I did, and was stunned by the changes he noted in just 10 years. Pointe du Uc, a mile farther down the beach from Omaha, where Army Rangers had clambered the sheer rock face under heavy machine gun fire, now looked like a Disney World ride, with state-of-the-art observation towers and panoramas. I was reminded of a recent attempt by some commercial-minded entrepreneurs to turn an infamous Virginia Civil War battlefield into a Civil War-themed amusement park. This plan was actually considered seriously until many notable historians and writers, including William Styron, vehemently spoke out against it and put a stop to it. But every war has had its great writers, soldiers who witnessed the ugliness and were not fooled by lies of grandeur. I thought of Stendhal, who survived Napoleon's retreat from Russia, and Tolstoy, who survived the Battle of Sevastopol, and read Stendhal to learn and understand how to write about war, all the way down to my father, James Jones, who read both Stendhal and Tolstoy and laughed his head off at their gallows humor and their elegant descriptions of young men's hunger for glory. I stopped writing for several years. I'd lost hope in the literary novel. In the midst of this crisis in 2002, I spent a month in Paris with my husband and my daughter organizing the James Jones Literary Society yearly symposium, which was held at the American University of Paris. Norris Church Mailer, George Plimpton, and Norman Mailer came and performed their play, Zelda, Scott, and Ernest, before a crowd of hundreds at the American Church on the Quai d'Orsay, to raise funds for our society. A well-known French literary journalist, François Brunel, wanted to interview Norman for French radio, and Norman asked me to be his translator. Brunel's first question was about the September 11th terrorist attacks. I was so stunned by Norman's response that I forgot to translate. Norman laughed and said he was amused that the French were more interested in his opinions of 9/11 than the Americans. He said with a bemused smile that literary writers' opinions no longer mattered in the United States, and that the time of the great American novel had passed. In the 40s, a few writers thought they could change the world, he said. From Here to Eternity, for example, changed the U.S. Army. Norman said, I still think that's the role of literature, to try to change the world, but that's no longer what preoccupies American writers, unfortunately. If I had to do it over, I'd be a film director. Buddy explained, this did not mean that we could stop taking a stand and stop hollering when it was time to holler. Brunel and Norman looked at me, expecting my simultaneous translation, but I was so busy listening and thinking that for a moment I'd forgotten why I was there. I quickly resumed. After Brunel and his crew left, I told Norman I thought that the tower card in the tarot deck was eerily descriptive of what had happened on September 11th. How interesting, he said. Do you read tarot cards? I told him I'd been studying it. I was interested. And I'd been studying the tarot for years. He asked me if I had my cards with me. I didn't. They were back in my hotel, my friend's apartment. Oh, too bad, he said. I read cards too. Norman added, I find them fascinating. I used to read my cards every day, but it began to obsess me, so I stopped. We should trade readings sometime. "Norman," I blurted, "I haven't written a word in ages. It's probably been 2 years. I was so depressed over the fate of literature that I felt compelled and completely useless. I felt compelled to stop. But now, listening to you, I see it's not an option. I have to write. I see it's more important now than ever." "Yes, it is," he said, "even more so when you do it without any expectation of success." Now I looked up the green cliff face to the top where on a white esplanade the tourists had crowded to gaze down at Omaha Beach. Why did everyone look so joyful? I was thinking of Norman's words and wondering if I would have become a novelist if I'd known back in 1981 that the literary novel would hold so little sway in the years to come. Well, too late now, I thought. I don't know how to do anything else. Not a thing, except teach. Time to start writing. Again. I limped slowly back up the steep, uneven path to the cemetery and made my way through the crowds to the parking lot where our bus stood waiting. As I approached the bus, I saw Richard Price standing a few feet away looking pensive. "I didn't feel what I thought I would feel," he said, his voice hollow. "I don't know. It was strangely unemotional." "I was here before," I replied awkwardly. "I was here with my father. He brought me. It was so quiet. There was no one here." Richard nodded. In silence, we made our way back to our seats on the sunny bus. Thank you.